Good evening, comrades, and thank you all for being here this evening. My name is Akam Janke, and welcome to the Oman Growth Forum. Before we get into today's proceedings, I'd like to speak a bit about the Oman Growth Forum and what we are, and the series of forums we've been hosting over the past few weeks and will be continued to host over the next 2 months. So as you all know, firstly, the Oman Growth Forum is a space in which allows for critical engagement and allows a platform for engaging with ideas that matter to working class people, to women, to all marginalized and oppressed peoples, and also geared towards sort of offering a space for espousing sort of ideas and building something from these important contributions to the discourse. Over the past few weeks, Amanda, Ilrig, and Workers Wield Media Productions have been hosting a few series of forums on the labor movement in particular because of its importance in left-wing politics. And the first forum we had was about is the labor movement under attack? And today's forum is about patriarchy, power, and the labor movement. As you all have received the invite, we had three speakers proposed for today's evening. Prakashni Govender is here with us, Nozizwe Beya, and Lumka Tembo. Unfortunately, Lumka and Nozizwe both couldn't make it this evening. Lumka is currently in the Eastern Cape with a family bereavement, and Nozizwe has throat ulcers, which wouldn't allow her to speak today. So unfortunately, they won't be joining us. However, our chair will be coming tonight, and Prakashni is here. And we do hope that this conversation will help with the engagement on the labor movement. Obviously, it's exhaustive. It doesn't cover all the perspectives on patriarchy, power, and the labor movement, but these are still valuable contributions to the topic and the labor movement in general. So I'll give off to our chair, Cam Newton-Iper, who can sort of contextualize the discussion, and hope that comes.
Thanks, Rakan. Okay, welcome, everyone. Like you said, I'm Kamalita Naika. I'm going to be chairing the discussion this evening, and it's really unfortunate that the two people from Kosatu and Salupso aren't able to be with us today, but we do have Prakashni still. So what we thought we could do is to have her input and then maybe just open it up for a general discussion. And maybe we can just speak about why this conversation is necessary and how is it placed in the general conversation that the Amanla Forum's been having. This is the third Amanla Forum in the series. So I think that one of the main reasons why this conversation is happening now, and I guess has been happening over the last 2 years or so, is because of the way in which gender and patriarchy have in general come to a kind of center stage in political life in South Africa, but also more broadly, and really how it makes us think about not just patriarchy or gender as these abstract constructs, but really how this is working in our movements, right? How it's working in elections, how it's working in the general institutional life of political movements, and in particular the trade union, right? And how some of the ways, and Amanla hosted a forum, I think, 2 years ago after the Me Too movement and the Men Are Trash movement, to speak really about how we think about even the processes of elections, of caucusing, of, you know, consensus building, and the way it works in the labor movement, and really how these themselves can contribute sometimes to a patriarchal structure of power in these movements. So I think that's the context in which we want to have the discussion, and we can speak a bit more about that. It's very unfortunate that our two trade unions are not here. But I'm going to hand it over to Prakashni, and then we can open it up for conversation. Also, as a disclaimer, Prakashni says that she feels comfortable if anybody needs clarification on some of the concepts, or, you know, if you do have a clarifying question, just raise your hand and we can come to you. And I'll also try to intervene from the chair. Okay.
Good evening, everyone, comrades. Thank you for coming to this discussion. Thank you to AIDC and Workers World and ILRIG for organizing this. I just thought, first I want to introduce myself. I asked Kamita to, because it's a little bit more complicated, that I just take the opportunity to introduce myself. I worked for COSATU for 13 years. That was from 2001 to 2014. And then I left because I had fundamental problems with the direction that the organization was taking. And specifically, I worked for the parliamentary office. And for most of that period, it was with the as the head of the office. Subsequently, more than a year later, I joined NUMSA. In between, I had a study break. I joined NUMSA, and that was primarily on the basis of what we thought at the time was going to be the promise of the NUMSA moment. I only worked at NUMSA for a year because in between my study break and going to NUMSA, I discovered that really what had been the NUMSA moment had been squandered, and that there were fundamental problems, organizationally speaking, and in relation to just questions around work, you know, membership democracy and that kind of thing, and you know, that the organization had really turned into a fairly authoritarian organization. So I left that organization, left NUMSA, and I also stated my objections in clear terms, made it clear in terms to the national leadership, who were actually part of my recruitment. So that actually comes as a disclaimer, because a lot of what I'm going to say obviously may be read as criticism that arises from my relationship with the trade union movement. But truthfully, I still identify most strongly with the labor movement. And while I don't have any immediate plans to return there just yet, I haven't ruled out the fact that I will eventually go back. That's regardless, you know. So I would want the whatever I say to be seen within that context. On the topic of patriarchy, power, and the labor movement, now this is, I mean, there's no way I can do justice to the topic, and it's actually a really massive issue. If you think about the fact that trade unions just operate on multiple levels, not just in relation to their membership, it could be other NGOs, but it's also moving out of the local arena, they operate on the international level. So you have international relations in terms of global unions. I cannot deal with all of that today. And in fact, I think that's a much bigger topic. Even if we had to constrain it to the local context, we are still talking about a massive context. I think today we are gripped with the idea of patriarchy and power and labor movement as if it's a separate issue. But truthfully, I think that the much, much more complex issue, and which it will be difficult to air out here, is that the fragmentation and the real crisis of the labor movement is actually tied into patriarchy, the way in which they've always operated. And it's, you know, obviously now come to this point. But I'm not going to deal with that big macro picture. I was specifically asked to come to speak about sexual harassment and patriarchy. And you know, to the best extent, I'm going to try and do that. I'm going to use, there's not much documentation that you'll find in the labor movement on that issue. I'm basically going to be talking very personally based on my interactions, my observations, and my own personal experiences. And this is the first time that I'm doing it in a public forum, just because I think it's that important. But before I do that, I just want to turn to the invite that everybody received to AIDC's forum today. And one of the things it talks about is the pervasiveness of patriarchy and misogyny in the workplace. It talks about an entrenched culture of patriarchy and sexism, with many women and queer women people being not in leadership positions within unions, and it goes on, you know. And then it asks us to look at what we can do about that. The biggest problem that we have is that this is not a labor forum. Nowhere will you find in any labor forum, in any labor discussion, any union, it doesn't matter if it's COSATU or FEDUSA or, you know, Solidarity, that they will admit that this is a problem, and that this is a pervasive, entrenched problem. So you're not going to get to resolve, you'd have to actually deal with the fact is, how do we get the labor movement to even admit that there is this problem before we begin? And it doesn't matter that you have people of the left in this room, people who are labor friendly, it really is down to the organization to take that approach, to actually make that admission. Before focusing on sexual harassment, and comrades, please, because we have more time, we have less speakers, just if you feel like you need to get me to clarify something, then just, you know, we can keep like questions for discussion for later, but for clarification purposes, just stop me to just explain something so that I don't carry confusion into the rest of the discussion, because I know that that not everyone is a trade unionist, and sometimes I forget, obviously, who I'm speaking to, and you assume certain things. I actually want to focus on the question of women's representation in leadership and in structures of the labor movement, and also how this impacts on the agenda of the labor movement. I'll deal with this quite briefly. If you all have been following, or if you follow COSATU, and I don't know if people do that much anymore, but last year there was a very dramatic moment where the first woman president was elected. And this comes back, you know, against a backdrop where there have been decades of calls for equivalent, 50-50 representation among the national elected leadership of unions. I thought there was a sort of clarification, okay. So historically, there's been resistance to having compelling a quota of 50% leadership of women in national leadership of the unions, as well as at the federation level, so for example at COSATU level. So this is obviously a fairly dramatic development. It should be positive development, but I think it should obviously be viewed within the context. You find that most unions who have historically elected women into national positions have tended to put them into what were implicitly junior positions, like your second deputy president. Not your president, not your first deputy president, but your second deputy president. And your treasurer. Your general secretary positions and even your deputy general secretary positions have historically been male, because even your DGS, your deputy general secretary, is seen as someone who will eventually take on that role of the general secretary. So there's that succession in mind. So there's that dynamic. The disjuncture between the quota and this compulsion in terms of arguing for a quota also comes from an imperative that for a long time, and it's very difficult to get accurate statistics from unions currently, and a lot of them are lying about the statistics, because we've actually lost members. Whether through the fact that people have lost jobs and can no longer be members, we don't have a situation where people can join as associate members as they do in some countries. We've also just lost membership from bad service. But for some time now, the statistics have looked like fairly close that membership of unions are, or overall, the overall membership is about almost 50% are actually women. So the call for 50% representation at a leadership level should obviously correlate with that as well. And apart from that, there are historically certain unions which are actually numerically dominated by women. So in the clothing sector, like SACTU, or teaching, that's SATU, the Southern African Democratic Teachers Union, and SAKAWU, which organizes in retailers like Pick and Pay or Edgar's. Those would be like your unions where on the shop floor the majority are women. And besides that, if you look at the public service, it's unclear, but you will see a substantial number of women, if not necessarily in the majority, but substantial, versus, for example, unions like the mining sector, where obviously there's overwhelmingly, until recently, just like, you know, I think because of quotas, an increase of workers, women workers in mining shafts. So I think for me that this is, it's just important to recognize that development, but also to contextualize it. And we actually do have to ask ourselves a question, does it necessarily reflect a shift in culture in the labor movement in relation to wanting to reverse or address patriarchy? Now, one of the roles that these junior NOBs, or National Office Bearers, as we would refer to them in trade unions, which historically be tasked with, is that they will be relegated, and I'm using the word relegated deliberately, to the gender issues. You'll find that in unions, at the federation level, and many individual unions will often have gender structures. In only some cases will you have a full-time gender coordinator. That's at the union level. At the federation level, let me speak about specifically about CUSATU. You have a national coordinator, but then at the provincial level, the administrator in each province is tasked with the gender role of coordinating gender matters in terms of the labor movement in that province. And the real problem with this is that it actually doesn't, while you involve the administrators in the narrow aspect of gender, they're not normally involved in other aspects of the main union work, whether it's in organizing, whether it's recruitment, whether it's in campaigns. So you find these administrators who are involved in, you know, it's basically, it's like a ghetto of an issue. And if you compare the difference in terms of how men enter the labor movement, it's and rise up into leadership positions, you'll find that they're two separate broad streams. You know, some of them are elected and move up from the shop floor, and eventually maybe to provincial structures or directly up to national level and can be elected as presidents. But there's another common example that happens where. And you'll find that, for example, the current SAFTU General Secretary, who was previously CUSATU General Secretary, came up through the secretariat of the union. You'll find that the men enter the labor movement in terms of the bureaucracy or in the employed section differently, which is, for example, in organizing or campaigns or education. Essentially giving them access to membership at provincial levels, the tools of the union to build their own capacity, and then obviously to progress. So when you have women at the administrative level who are confined to gender issues, but then actually not given any work to do in terms of the main work of the organizing, it actually means that you don't have a chance to actually impact and influence or mainstream gender in that way, in the rest of the union's agenda. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate that Lumka isn't here, coming from the CUSATU office, because essentially she's in that position, and it would be interesting to actually hear her perspective, because she may have a very different perspective from mine, because I worked at from a national level, and she may disagree with some of the criticisms that I'm going to raise. So you're not going to get that counter position. But for me, looking at the gender structures in the union and in the federation has always been very difficult to actually identify any real impact. And obviously it's also because it's been set, I mean, you can criticize the structure for being dysfunctional and for being weak, but it was set up in a way that was broken intentionally. And the real irony is that when we've had engagements, for example, at the policy level in terms of dealing with draft laws, and I'm sure this has happened in organizing and campaigns, is that the gender structure has had very little to offer on labor issues. And clearly, it's obvious that would happen, because if you don't have access to the information, it's not going to filter in. A couple of years ago, well, it was in, I think, 2012, just before the Marikana massacre, there was an incident where there was, her name is Pinky Mosiano, who was murdered and raped in a mine. And there were years, you know, later when actually that before anyone was arrested. And the The real problem with that situation is that when you look at how the story unfolded and the information that started to rise, was that there were NGOs involved in providing information, compelling attention for the case, not the unions. So there was the Workers' World Media Project. I think more recently, obviously, there was the Benchmarks Foundation, which looked at that, obviously took that incident and started to look at what was happening to women in the unions. And what they then identified for us was that, and I'd worked on a process previously called the Mining Charter, which actually compelled what was a minimum quota of requirement of in terms of the number of women that would be required to go and work in mines, to go underground, which created a situation where I think just, you know, about 10 to 15% of women were underground, but actually in situations where they were far outnumbered by men. So what happened was that an initially well-intentioned law, which was to try and increase women's representativity in the mining sector, backfired to a certain extent because it didn't take into account the situation it put them in terms of safety. I think what it also illustrates is that it's not easy to anticipate what happens, what the specific demands or the specific rights should be for women workers. If you sit with a piece of law and you look at it, it may look very good on the surface of it, but without actual information coming from the shop floor or from, in this case, the shaft, mining shaft floor, you're not going to be able to find or make proposals that are relevant to their situation. And for me, this actually illustrates, for example, how, where if you had a proper functioning gender structure in the mines, or even in another sector, for example, like farms, where we've had very little information coming from the unions themselves, but actually very compelling information has come forth from NGOs working in the area about the specific dynamics of farm workers. And like one example I can give was that women's housing was tied into their relationship with a partner on farms, which means that they weren't able to secure housing, their secure tenure of housing based on their own right. They had to have a husband or partner who had that access, and if that partner was subsequently dismissed, then their housing, they weren't able to secure their access. And that kind of information is not something that would naturally occur to you if you just look at a piece of legislation on its own at a national federation level. But if you had a gender structure that was engaging with women to understand the situation, then you would get that information to be able to anticipate and to mainstream gender. So this is a broad, and I have oversimplified a bit. I have oversimplified a bit, but this is the broad background that I'm trying to sketch in terms of what's been happening in terms of gender, you know, in terms of structure and representativity, that within which we should be talking about, you know, what do we do about sexual harassment in the unions. And I think the one thing that we also need to be mindful of is that unions operate in two spheres. The one is that the most often we're talking about, most people think about, is how they operate in the workplace. So how do they deal with sexual harassment between their own members? Which is, and we're not getting much information from that, but from the Pinky Mosiani case, and there have been other cases and studies that have been done by NGOs, it's clear that the real problem is happening. We know that in the mining sector, but for sure we know that this is happening without actual information in other sectors as well. Separate from that, we've got to deal with the situation that the union is an employer as well, unions and federations. And in some cases, we're actually talking about fairly large unions. If you're talking about a union like LUMSA that organizes in the manufacturing sector, we're talking about having hundreds of employees. If we look at reports in the media about sexual harassment in the labor movement, you'll find very few reports that come to light. And actually, this, and we're talking about over the entire history of the labor movement. If we had to look at that, and also even then take into consideration the very few cases that are challenged internally using internal union procedures that don't necessarily come to light, public knowledge, that's also very low. And you may get the impression that there isn't a problem. I think it's very important to actually acknowledge, and this is based on my own observations, my own interactions with our union members and my own personal experience, that sexual harassment is pervasive. And it isn't, it's just, explicitly confirm that I have been subject to numerous examples, incidents of sexual harassment myself. In my case, because I was a senior official and because I was employed in a position that, you know, was normally ascribed for people with a higher education. And I find that with other people in similar situations, we had more power often to resist the most. And there's aggression always in sexual harassment, by the way. So just bear that in mind, I'm prefacing my comments here. The most aggressive forms of it. And I was able to, at least, because I was very defensive and preemptive about defending my space, ensure that it actually wasn't something that was relentless. I had that space and power. And additionally, I was located in a different office. The parliamentary office, which was located in Cape Town, was separate from the national office in Johannesburg. It was separate from the regional structure. So for most day-to-day operations, things are fine. Except, of course, when you went to constitutional meetings like Congress or the Central Executive Committee meetings, or we had processes where we involved other, leaders, for example, of the union movement. When I entered COSATU, before I entered COSATU, the reputation of the union as a space where women were not safe was already there. It was notorious, and I entered with that understanding and that knowledge. So I entered there with the attitude that I was going to be preemptive and defensive about my space. The reality is that there are many women in the labor movement who are much more vulnerable, who are not able to defend their space. And many of them, from my observation, maybe even the vast majority, I actually single them out, who in this current environment don't have the space to find other jobs. And let's just be honest, not necessarily in a space where people value union experience in terms of the general labor market. A lot of them are employed at the administrative level and in junior positions. And the one thing that I need to stress again, apart from the fact that aggression is always inherent part of sexual harassment, power is always present in instances of sexual harassment, even when we have people equally situated. But in the labor movement, when we're dealing with leaders involved in it, you have an additional element of power. I mean, we've all followed media articles where there are certain key high-profile figures that command huge attention. And I don't want to name them. But what it does is that the power imbalance just creates this additional element where it makes it not just harder to challenge, but these individuals are able to draw support in various ways to oppose or control or compel silence, whether it's through the media, whether it's through their membership. They're also able to call on support from outside their membership. In this way, silence is doubly enforced. We all understand how silence is enforced around gender-based violence generally in terms of societal rules. But in the union, it's doubly enforced. And I think that for me, this also now also the question of power also brings us to the other question in terms of the believability or the credibility of the. I prefer the use of the word victim to survivor, and that's a separate discussion. Why? It plays into that other problem. When we have leaders who have broad support and who have support members who are so invested in them, it actually creates a situation where a woman never has a chance to put forward her story and to believe. It doesn't matter what information she produces or the circumstances. And this isn't a problem that just grips the labor movement. It's actually a problem with the entire left. You know, we've seen, if you've been following the whole dynamic that has unraveled, for example, equal education, you've seen how high-profile people can compel support from outside their own quarters, from their networks, including in this case, a retired judge, who not only condemned the complainant in that case for not wanting to be anonymous, but virtually everyone else, based on her own limited experience, that she would be prepared, be available to be named. And her experience is not in line with the general experience out there. So this is the difficulty we're facing in the left, not just in the labor movement. That when you're faced with a scenario, people lose their rationality. You know, it's based on their relationship with this leader, whether or not they believe this person. We have situations where, you know, we've had things like the honeypot or honey trap, where supposedly someone has been set up by a particular faction for particular political reasons and lays herself open and her life to go and, you know, ambush a leader to sway him away from his main purpose, which is union business. Or it's about attention seeking. Or you got a vendetta, or you know, it's all these things. But this is, and this for me is a real concern with the problem with labor, within the left, is that when you're faced with a scenario and you don't have all the facts, the normal rational thing to do is to go for the more logical, more plausible, credible version, which is not to believe the honeypot theory, which belongs in, you know, Cold War spy novels. It's to understand that, and from my experience, from all the women I interact with, the broader circles, including the ones that I don't like, including ones that I would normally consider attention seekers, they will not use this to call for attention. My experience is that women hide it. So if you want to turn, and this is what happens in large organizations, you are prepared to turn your life around and be overwhelmed by, it's like an avalanche going after an ant. My view, based on my experience, is that there's got to be some compelling reason that you've decided to take this on in principle. I've dealt with, to some extent, the question of power. I want to actually turn on to recent developments that happened that have been happening recently from the labor movement, which you would think would suggest that dealing with gender-based violence and sexual harassment is not being prioritized, but which from my reading doesn't appear to be the case. We also need to bear in mind that as a result of the whole Me Too movement, the ILO, the International Labour Organization, has just adopted an international convention on gender-based violence and sexual harassment, which unions are going to be compelled to promote and lobby for different countries to ratify and accede to. There's also, because of the Me Too movement, a lot of pressure from global unions and international organizations for unions to be seen, I'm stressing the word, to be seen to be dealing with gender-based violence. So a lot of these recent activities need to be contextualized within that backdrop, from my view. So there's three examples that I can tell, and three doesn't sound like a lot, but three in a space of just over 6 months is a massive amount for the labor movement to suddenly start engaging with. In November last year, SAFTU, the South African Federation of Trade Unions, or the federation that formed as a result of the breakaway from COSATU, released a statement and a report against condemning the sexual harassment report that emanated from investigations in the SABC. Earlier this year in March, NUMSA issued a statement in support of a worker at UNISA who's been fighting for 2 years. They released a statement in March this year. saying they express solidarity with her. And then they, in their statement, say that the victims have routinely encountered disbelief, trivialization, or minimization of the experience or expectations, doubt and undermining of their accounts, with no sense of irony, with no sense of reflection on their own internal operations. And in the last, less than a month ago, I don't know if comrades have been watching, there was a strike in a coal mine called Lanzas, or whatever the pronunciation is, Lanzas or something like that. It's got an X in there, which I don't know how to pronounce it. But, and the media, you know, this is where you realize that the media is not very smart, because with a little bit of investigation, you'll be able to read between the lines. But, and it's also, I mean, I should be encouraged that the media is reporting fairly positively about a strike. So just on the last month, in this mine, about 280 workers went on strike. It was an unlawful strike, unprotected strike, which means that they didn't comply. You have to, in order for you to embark on a protected strike, you have to comply with certain rules, and they hadn't. And it was supported by NUMSA. What was reported in the media was that this was a strike, and included, obviously, predominantly male workers were there, because, I mean, numerically, they outnumber the women workers. They had down tools because they were challenging a case of sexual harassment where the sex pest, that's the word they used, had been allowed to continue to work. But reading between the lines, there are other demands. The union, NUMSA, wanted recognition. It didn't have recognition. And when you talk about union recognition, it means that you have certain additional rights to organize, which means you have direct access to workers, you can have time off. It makes it easier to recruit. So normally that kind of right is granted to unions who have the most members, which doesn't make sense, because if you have the most members, it means that you're able to block smaller unions out. So, I mean, I am critical of that. And they also were calling on the reinstatement of workers that had been dismissed last year for another unrelated protest action. So when this incident first came out, it was like, you know, why am I being skeptical? Obviously I'm critical. I find it highly unusual that men are going to down tools for sexual harassment. This is unpaid. I mean, whether it's a protected strike or unprotected strike, you don't get paid. No work, no pay is what we're applying. We don't have strike funds in the country. Well, unions have never bothered setting them up. And the media is just, and in some cases, the media just reported that it hasn't mentioned the other demands. They've just basically said they've down tools because of sexual harassment, and they've now supporting these women workers. And I'm, you know, where's it? So what kicked off this revolution? What am I missing, you know? And it took a bit of digging to actually find there was a statement released that the media hasn't picked up on. It's there in plain sight. You can Google it and find it. NUM, National Union of Mine Workers, different from NUMSA, also the majority union, released a statement condemning, well, the headline says, "We condemn the alleged sexual harassment at the Lanzas mine." But when you read the actual statement, they're not condemning it. Their member is the one who is now accused of committing the sexual harassment. This is essentially a proxy battle. The sexual harassment case is a proxy battle for two unions, NUMSA and NUMSA, to gain union recognition against a majority union, which is the National Union of Mine Workers. It also represents other proxy battles that we've had. We've had factional battles in the union itself regarding when Zweli Mzimavati was the general secretary, and that was involving a junior worker. And here's the difficulty that we face right now. And this is, I'm speaking to you as activists of the left. Just because an organization is prepared to exploit an opportunity to take up a sexual harassment for other objectives does not then invalidate the underlying complaint. The truth is always complicated. That's the norm. It's not an exception. We've got to learn to deal with that. We've got to learn to have nuanced responses. That doesn't mean that because we support a leader, we think that they actually we can't survive with a particular leader, we don't have alternatives, or we feel that they've contributed so much that we give them permission to exploit power. So, I mean, and this obviously, you know, it then, apart from raising the question about the sincerity within which, or genuineness that this sexual harassment is taking up, we have to ask the question, when are unions going to be able to take up the case of sexual harassment for its own sake, rather than to deal with other agendas? Whether it's a political agenda or whether it's organizing on the shop floor.
I think maybe we can leave it there for now and have a bit of a... Unless you have a concluding... Okay, so I just want to say thank you to Prakashni for that input. Yeah, and maybe we can open it up for discussion. But I mean, before we do that, I think that there were, if I may say from the chair, several very important points that you raised and that I also noticed during my brief period of working at NUMSA. And I think one of the most important, and maybe this is a good way to think about it, as part of the more broad left, is really how the distinction keeps getting made between what is political and what is not, what is revolutionary politics and what is not. And I think in my experience, the way in which this constantly came up as an issue that was not part of politics, that was not part of the how we conceptualize what is political, was the issue. So gender is always something that can be attached, or gender is something outside of the daily functioning of the union or the kind of work of the union. So you can have a good comrade who sexually harasses someone, right? Or you can have a good leader who is, a bit misogynist, or you can have, you know, all of these leaders who can have very much tap into the honeypot theory. And so I think what we also need to think about, maybe as people who consider themselves on the left, is really what we think a good comrade is. You know, who's a good comrade? Because if a good comrade can have good politics but is still capable of sexual harassment, or then I think that maybe we need to really rethink our categories here of good comrade or good revolutionary politics, because this means that you obviously don't think gender is a political issue and should be part of, you know, your understanding of politics the same way as which you can, you know, recite Marx and Engels, you know. So I just wanted to add that, and I see many hands, so